Come on in, everybody. Please take your seat. If you're coming in from the back of the room, please come forward. Thank you. Also, everybody, please be sure to silence your phones, your smartwatches, whatever. So welcome to the session, Thinking in Bets. My name is Mary Ellen Kasatykes, and I'm proudly here on behalf of Oracle Women's Leadership. We have a very robust global program supporting the development, engagement, and empowerment of women. We have communities in 95 communities in 46 countries, and so happy to be here supporting Watermark for several years now. So it is my delight to introduce our keynote speaker here. I'm going to read from my notes so that I don't miss a beat, because this is really an incredible woman that we're going to hear from. Annie Duke is an author, she's a corporate speaker, and she's a consultant on the behavior of decision making. She wrote a book. Her first book was on thinking in bets, making smarter decisions when you don't have all the facts, and it quickly became a national bestseller. For those of you who did not take time to read the description, but the title caught your attention, I want to tell you that Annie Duke is a former professional poker player. She has won more than $4 million in tournament poker. During her career, she actually won the World Series poker bracelet, which I don't know what that is. I don't know if you're wearing it, Annie. Maybe you can show it to us. Okay, not wearing it today. She's the only woman to have won the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions. Yippee! You know, she's a mother of four plus a stepmother of two. I asked her if she teaches her kids how to play poker, but I don't know if she'll let us know the true secret on that. And she has raised more than $18 million for charities. She's the co-founder of How I Decide, and she's joined the board of directors of the Franklin Institute, which is one of America's oldest and greatest science museum. And I think this is a fun fact about Annie Duke. She won a televised championship of rock, paper, scissors. Okay, so please join me in welcoming Annie Duke.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for that lovely intro. So, first of all, I just want to say, like, I give a lot of talks to people, you know, that are more kind of in finance, and so I'm really appreciative of this room, because the ratio is usually reversed. So it's so nice for me to be speaking to a sea of women. So thank you for being here, and thank you for coming to listen to me. I started off my adult life, actually, at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was studying cognitive psychology, getting my PhD there. And particularly, I was thinking about there, how do you learn when the feedback is really noisy? So at the end of my time there, I did 5 years there, and I was going out to go on the path that I was expecting to go on, which was to go become a professor and stay in academics. Right as I was going out to start interviewing for jobs in academia, I got sick. I had been struggling with some stomach problems. They really got bad right around the time that I was supposed to go out for my job interviews. I actually ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. And the job cycle in academics is seasonal. So once I had missed those interviews, I really had to wait until the next year. So now I had to take some time to try to recuperate from this illness. And I found out that while when I was at school, I had a National Science Foundation fellowship, when you leave, they take it away. And I didn't have any money. So I thought, what am I going to do for money now? And my brother, Howard Letterer, who was already quite a well-known poker player at that point, said, hey, you know, I've taught you some poker. Why don't you try playing some poker in the meantime while you're waiting to get back out into academics? So I started playing poker, and the meantime turned into 18 years. I retired in 2012. I'm sure that that's exactly what the National Science Foundation had in mind when they gave me that money. No doubt. But actually, about 8 years into my time as a poker player, I got asked by a group, a hedge fund actually, to come and speak to their options traders about how the game of poker might inform someone's thinking about risk. I was actually 9 months pregnant with my fourth child. I had the baby 2 weeks later. I couldn't find any shoes that fit, so I did it in bare feet. You all know how that's like. And it was that moment, it was the first moment where I really realized that while I thought that I had taken this total left turn and completely abandoned this previous life that I had, that actually I had been doing and studying the exact same thing that I had been studying when I was in graduate school. I was just using a different laboratory to study it. Because it made me start thinking about, in an explicit way, how could I communicate to people what the problems are that we have with learning. And that had been what I was studying before. In fact, what I realized as I was going into that talk and what did I want to talk about was that when I was in graduate school, the first thing that they teach you, I mean, they teach you this in like Psych 1 when you're a freshman in college, is that learning occurs when they get lots and lots of feedback and it's tied closely in times to decision actions. So you do stuff, you decide stuff, then you get some sort of feedback, and then you learn. It's kind of classic if you think about like Pavlov's dogs, you know, they ring a bell, they give them food, they figure out the bell means food, you know. But when I was playing poker, I watched people who've been playing for years and years and years and years and years who were not learning. They were making the same mistakes over and over and over and over again and not changing their behavior despite the fact that if you want to design a system that's very feedback rich, where you get lots and lots of answers about your decisions, poker would be the ideal case. You do something, you find something out. You do something, you find something out. You win the hand, you lose the hand. People call, people fold. And this is all happening. A hand of poker only takes about 2 minutes. So you're getting lots and lots and lots of feedback about the quality of your decisions, and yet people are really not learning. And I realized as I was going into that first talk, well, this is a real head scratcher. Like, I'm a little confused about this. Let me think about that. And that was actually what I gave my first talk on in 2002. And for the next decade, I actually overlapped the careers. And I was playing poker, mostly what you saw on television. I did pretty well. You know, I won some stuff, and that was all great. But I was also really getting back to this academic work and thinking about how do we learn from poker about decisions. In 2012, I retired, ended up writing this book. And now here I am in front of you today, and this is what I do full-time besides the full-time job of raising my children. So I have ways to get in contact with me up there because I actually really enjoy a good conversation. So please reach out to me. I also do a newsletter that you can sign up for at www.annieduke.com, and you can see past versions of it. And it's just sort of a newsletter on decision making every Friday. So let's get into it. So interestingly, we're going to talk about football to start. So does anybody know what situation this is? So go ahead. Say it. Hello. So Super Bowl. Well, we know it's the Super Bowl because the Patriots are in it. Right? All right. So the Patriots here are going for their fifth win. And they're against the Seattle Seahawks. And you can see the Seahawks are on the 1 yard line. So they've only got to move the ball 1 yard to get into the Patriots end zone. And then they're down by four. So if they can actually score a touchdown here, they're going to win the game. It's the fourth quarter, and there's only 26 seconds left in the game. So this is like right at the end of the game. And you can see it's second and goal. And the Seahawks happen to have one timeout here. It's not so important for our discussion, but we'll get to it. So anyway, I'm going to play this video. And I don't. You're going to see that what happens here is that the quarterback does something very unexpected. So Pete Carroll, who's the coach of this team, calls something very unexpected. He has the quarterback pass the ball here. And what he's expected to do is have him hand it off to the running back, whose name is Marshawn Lynch, because that would be the usual thing that you would do in this situation. But he doesn't do that. He has them call a pass play. You're going to see that it's a complete and spectacular failure. So that will happen very quickly. But then what I really want you to listen to is the announcer. It's a guy named Chris Collingsworth, and I want you to listen to what he says.
Play clock at five. pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Unreal.
They tried to pick play, Al. They tried to go here, but he beats them to the punch. And I'm sorry, but I can't believe the call.
Me neither.
I cannot believe the call. You've got Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. You've got a guy that's been borderline unstoppable in this part of the field. I can't believe the call.
It's got to be one of the dumbest calls offensively in Super Bowl history.
Yeah. So, Chris Collinsworth can't believe the call. Now, he clearly thinks that this is a really bad play call. And you notice that as he's saying that, he's not really giving us any information about what the quality of that pass call is, right? Like, he's not saying, well, here's how often that was going to work compared to this other thing that might happen. He's not really giving us any analysis. He's just announcing that it was a terrible call. But to be fair to Chris Collinsworth, he's doing it like on the fly, right? Like, he doesn't have any time to sit and work out the math. So let's see what happens to people who have some time to think about it. And we can look at what the headlines are the next day about this play. They aren't any better. So there seems to be a battle of, was it the worst play in Super Bowl history? Or USA Today makes the bold call if it's the worst play in NFL history. All right, so even after people have had time to think about this, they're saying, no, this is a really terrible call. So let's see what Pete Carroll had to say about it. This was on Good Morning America. He was really being pressed to sort of do a mea culpa, like admit that this was the worst thing that anybody had ever decided to do. And you can see that his answer to, you know, was this really the worst call was, it was the worst result of a call ever. And I put an emphasis on the word result. And he adds, the call would have been a great one if we catch it. It would have been just fine, and nobody would have thought twice about it. Now, I actually have a big quibble with it would have been just fine, and nobody would have thought twice about it, because let's just take a moment to do the thought experiment. So everybody just take a moment. Imagine Pete Carroll makes this unusual decision. Let's call it bold. And he decides to pass the ball. And the ball gets caught for a touchdown in the end zone, the game-winning touchdown for the Seahawks. What do you think the headlines look like the next day? A coach's brilliant call. He's all of a sudden a genius. There's nothing in between. He's either a moron or he's a genius. And it seems to depend on whether it actually works out, which is kind of interesting because we know that on one single try, whether it actually works out does not tell us very much. It's kind of like saying, if I flip a coin and I call tails and it happens to land tails, that you should consider to me to be a great coin flipping caller. That would not be so good. And actually, what's interesting is that we actually have a real world example of how much the outcome of the decision actually matters for us figuring out what we think about the quality of the decision. And it happened 2 years ago. How do we know it's the Super Bowl again? Well, the Patriots are in it. This time they're against the Eagles. Just full disclosure, I'm from Philadelphia, so this is a little gratuitous. But we can see that, all right, we're in a little bit of a similar situation. This is fourth and goal. It's the very end of the second quarter. The Eagles are on the Patriots' 1 yard line, so we're in a similar spot on the field. There's also an expected play. The expected play is to go for a field goal to get 3 points. Now Philadelphia's up by 3 here. If they get 3 points, they'll go up by 6. Turns out this mathematically, statistically, that doesn't help you much more than being up by 3. So Doug Peterson does actually what's mathematically correct. He says, actually, I want to try to score a touchdown here. So surprisingly, he doesn't go for a field goal. Instead, he decides he's going to try to score a touchdown. He does this by having a pass play thrown. The pass is going to go to literally the exact same spot of the end zone. It's the same place that the ball is passed to. There's going to be a strange thing that happens, which is the quarterback doesn't throw the ball. He becomes the receiver. All of this is very weird. All right, so this is very unexpected what happens, but you're gonna see in this particular case it works out, and you're gonna hear the exact same announcer, Chris Collingsworth. And I assume, I'm sure you guys assume, that he's gonna go, I can't believe the play. Why didn't he just go for the field goal? Let's see if that's what he says.
Fourth and goal. And they're gonna snap it, and it's Trey Burton who throws, caught, falls, touchdown.
Here we go. They've got all these signals. Shotgun, he would not have been eligible, but for the fact he was in the shotgun, not under center. And there's the old basketball player. They talk about Nick Foles. He's more comfortable playing quarterback like a point guard, and here he is receiving the pass that is going to be shown a billion times.
Now, obviously, we can do with the reverse thought experiment if that pass fails and they go to lose the game. We know that that's what they're going to be talking about. And it's going to be, I can't believe the call. So what's going on here? Like, why is this happening? And it's because of something called resulting. So basically what resulting is when we take the quality of an outcome, is the outcome good or bad, and we use it to work backwards to figure out what the quality of the decision is. All right? Because what's happening is that we can clearly see the outcome. It's good or bad. What we can't see so well is the quality of the decision, because that requires a whole bunch of probabilistic thinking and map, you know, trying to recreate someone's decision tree, trying to figure out what they knew, what they didn't know, how much luck was involved. And that's very opaque to us. It's hard for us to see. So we use the thing that we can see, the outcome, and we use that to figure out what the quality of the decision is. Now, this is obviously a big problem. Now, just so that you know, just on that Pete Carroll play, I'm going to give you one fact that should get you to sort of think, well, maybe that wasn't such a bad decision. The chances of that play failing in that way as an interception were only 1%. Right? That's shocking, right? Because it feels like it should be a lot higher once you see that it failed. But it's actually about 1%. So this is the way that we want to be thinking about decisions. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is that when we're thinking about resulting, we're forgetting that there's a lot of uncertainty in the way that things turn out. Our decisions are not deterministic. They don't drive us to a foregone conclusion. So there's always more possible outcomes, more possible ways that the future can unfold than the way it actually does unfold. So what can poker actually teach us about this? Well, this is sort of a general definition of poker. Poker is a game of decision making under conditions of uncertainty over time. I'm not going to worry too much about the time thing, but let's talk about the uncertainty thing. So I've got here who's John von Neumann and why should you care. Does anybody here know who John von Neumann is? Do I have any? This one, that's about my average for a room. Okay, so I'm going to try to get us to John von Neumann. Does anybody know who John Nash is? A lot more John Nashes, right? Does anybody know who Russell Crowe is? Have any of you seen A Beautiful Mind? Great. So A Beautiful Mind starred Russell Crowe. He was playing an economist whose name was John Nash. John Nash, as you recall, had schizophrenia. John Nash is a Nobel Prize winner, he's passed. And he was studying something called game theory. His mentor, his advisor at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, which is where that movie takes place, was a guy named John von Neumann. John von Neumann did a whole bunch of stuff in his life before he died in his 50s. He was the father of the modern computer. That's pretty good. He ran the Manhattan Project. So he was the one who developed the bomb. He actually was the architect of our Cold War strategy, and he came up with the concept of mutually assured destruction. So he's a pretty famous guy. I think the reason why people don't know who he is because he was competing with Einstein for branding. And let's just be honest, Einstein had great branding. Amazing hair, the mustache, and the bicycle. What are you gonna do? Anyway, John von Neumann, when he was working on the Manhattan Project at night, as his like night job, his like side hustle, was writing a book called The Theory of Games with a guy named Oscar Morgenstern. And this was really the first putting forth this idea of game theory. So he really figured out this framework within which to think about decisions, which is game theory. And game theory is the study of decision making under conditions of uncertainty over time. Well, that seems to match up with the definition of poker. Why is that? Because John Von Neumann actually based game theory on poker, on a stripped-down version of poker. Because what he understood is that if we want to understand how people are deciding when there's uncertainty, and uncertainty comes from two sources, luck and hidden information, what we really need to do is model it on a game where those conditions occur. So in poker, there's lots of luck, right? Because there's the turn of the cards that you can't control. And there's lots of hidden information. Everybody's cards are face down, and you're trying to make decisions under those circumstances. Now, he was asked by a colleague of his, why didn't you base game theory on the game of chess? Isn't chess like the ultimate game? And his response was to the effect of, well, chess isn't really a game, it's just a calculation. Poker's a game. So what did he mean by that? Well, in chess, you're taking away all of this uncertainty, right? Like, nobody's rolling dice, and suddenly your queen comes off the board. And you can see your opponent's whole position. So therefore, you should be able to calculate out all the possible moves that they could make, and then all the moves you could make in response, and so on and so forth, and brute force to the end of the game. Now, what that means is that in a game like poker, resulting is a totally reasonable thing to do. If I play a game of chess against one of you, and I lose, and I go ask somebody, and all they haven't watched the game, all I say is, hey, I lost this game of chess to somebody. Who made better decisions? They can answer, the other person, right? Like, we know that in chess because we've lost all of this uncertainty. But if I play a half hour of poker with somebody and I lose and I go tell somebody just the result and I say, who made better decisions? Their answer better be, I don't know. Because in poker, we can't work backwards. And that's true in life as well. If I get in a car accident and that's all you don't know anything about my decision making when I was driving because you don't know if it was my fault or the other driver's fault because sometimes you go through green lights and you get in accidents. And for Pete Carroll, sometimes you pass the ball and it gets intercepted, even though the quality of the decision was really good because once he makes that decision, everything else is up to luck. And he's doing it under conditions where there's lots and lots of hidden information. He doesn't know what play, for example, the Patriots are going to run. All right, so this is going to tell us a lot about kind of what goes wrong with our decision making and how can we kind of fix it. So we know that outcomes and decisions are not tightly correlated, but we act like they are, right? So again, it's perfectly reasonable in chess to look at bad games to find where you made bad decisions, but it's not a perfectly reasonable strategy in poker. So once we understand that bets are like really, decisions are really like poker decisions, we can actually take that further and say, well, what is a decision really? Well, it's really a bet. All decisions that we make are bets. Because what we're doing is we're taking some sort of limited resource, like our time or our health or our happiness or our money, and we're investing it in an option, right? We're weighing different decisions, which are just weighing different options. And each of those options is not going to result in one future. The outcome is going to be lots and lots of different futures that have different probabilities of occurring. So as we're weighing options, we're thinking about what are the different futures that could occur given the option that I'm choosing and how often will those occur. And now I can sort of figure out which option I think is going to have the best return on what I've invested. Not just money, can be time and so on and so forth. And the other thing is that bets don't have to necessarily occur against other people. We can think about them occurring against other versions of ourselves. So as an example, if I'm sitting in a restaurant and I'm trying to decide, do I want to order the chicken or the fish? I'm thinking about, well, what are the outcomes of ordering the fish? What are the outcomes of ordering the chicken? I'm investing all sorts of limited resources because I'm not going to order both, so I've got to make a choice. And now, let's say I order the fish, and in the future Annie now gets the fish, and she hates it. And I say, oh, I should have ordered the chicken. That's the future that would have resulted, like Chicken Annie saying, ha ha, you should have chose me. Why didn't you bet on me? So we can really think about this framework of understanding that every decision we make is an investment. We're investing whatever we have, our time, our money, whatever, into some future that is not guaranteed. So it's a really big mistake once you have the future that actually occurs to think you know more than you do about whether the decision was good or not, because we have to remember that there's so many different ways that the future can turn out. Now, you can see on the left-hand side, I've got here beliefs. So here's where we really go wrong. Our beliefs inform the decisions that we make. Our beliefs tell us what we think is a good investment in the future and what isn't. Because we think about our beliefs in two ways. One, beliefs are facts. The Earth is round. That informs our decisions. We make decisions based on the roundness of the Earth. But beliefs also come in the form of what we believe those different futures are going to be, like the Earth is round tomorrow. So beliefs are facts and predictions, and they inform the kinds of decisions we make. And so if we think about the foundation of all the decisions we make, we've got to get our beliefs in order. So let's take a moment to think about our beliefs, because this is really where we go wrong. It's where poker players go wrong. It's really the answer to the question of what was happening to these people who played poker for 20 years and didn't seem to be learning. Does anybody know the answer to this? How do you predict if a man's going to go bald? Can I get... Just anybody, go ahead. The maternal grandfather. The maternal grandfather, yeah, does that sound right? So, okay, so before I wrote the book, I believed that as well. So let me ask you a question, actually. What would happen to you if I said to you, do you want to bet on that? Hold that thought. So she said I would say no. Hold that thought. I like that. So here's the truth. Baldness anywhere in a man's family tree is a predictor for hair loss. That's kind of interesting, right? Okay, here's some more. Astronauts didn't eat astronaut ice cream. I'm so sad. Abner Doubleday didn't invent baseball. I was like super shocked about that. I remember learning that one in like first grade. Immigrants' names weren't changed at Ellis Island. So it's not that some of them didn't change, it's that they weren't intentionally changed by any immigration agents. So they may have been misspelled, or people might have changed their own name on purpose to Americanize them, but the immigration agents weren't like my maternal grandmother was Perawaski. She wasn't like, sorry, you're now Perry, which is what she ended up being. That was her choice. Okay, so that's pretty surprising. Like, how many of you believe some of these things prior to me putting this up? Okay, so these are relatively low-stakes decisions, I suppose, because I assume none of you are historians of Ellis Island walking around with this wrong belief. But trust me, this is like all of your beliefs, right? So the reason why when I said, do you want to bet on this, you said no, is because it made you think some things, which we're going to get into, which is like, wait a minute, how do I know this, right? So we go around with these beliefs that we think are true, but maybe we haven't actually thought them through so much. So let's see what's happening. Right, so we want to think about, like, how do we actually form beliefs? The intuitive order goes like this. We hear something, we vet the information, deciding whether it's true or not. So we take some time to think about it, yeah? And then we form a belief. Does that sound about right? Yeah, that feels good, right? So here's how we actually do it. We hear it, we believe it, and then maybe if we have the motivation or time later, we vet it. Okay, so there's lots and lots of studies that show this. If you look in my book, there's a great study by Dan Gilbert that shows that we just default to believe and then maybe we vet it later. But I can tell you kind of why this is. If you think about most of human history, the only way that we could form beliefs was through our perceptual system. So I would see things or touch them. And if I see a tree in front of me, there's really no reason to do step three, because we're rarely hallucinating and we normally don't see mirages. So you can think about, for most of what our brain, you know, of our brain's development, we're just seeing stuff and then we believe it. So once we have the ability to communicate abstract thoughts, like I can tell you something about Ellis Island that you haven't experienced for yourself, basically your brain went, oh, I know how to form beliefs. I see things, I believe them. So, okay, that's what I'll do with this information too. That's the first reason. The second reason is that the believers tended to survive. So the people who weren't doing a lot of vetting were more likely to survive. Why? Because if you hear rustling in the leaves, it's really good to run away and not say, I wonder if this is a lion. Let me do some checking. And then you're dead. And then the third reason is that also, if you think about it, particularly within a tribe, if you thought that the things you were hearing weren't true, the things that people were telling you weren't true, why would there be any reason to speak to people? So human discourse would literally break down if we didn't just sort of believe things that we heard. So there's all these pressures on us to believe things without vetting them. Now, that might not be such a bad thing as long as you actually got to step three, right? Like when I said, do you want to bet, I forced you into step three. Right? I forced you to actually think about this stuff. Like, oh, let me think about that. So the question is, like, are we getting to step three? And here's the issue. is that even when we're presented with information that disconfirms a belief we have, we're not very good at using it. So we hear things, we believe them, and then here's the problem. Once we have a belief, we notice and seek out confirming evidence. So that's confirmation bias. So, for example, if you believe that it's the maternal grandfather that predicts baldness, then you're going to notice bald men whose maternal grandmothers are bald. And if somebody else, you know, you're not going to notice the other examples. So you notice stuff that confirms you. You can probably feel this in your political reading, that you notice data and people who are speaking who confirm the things that you already believe, and maybe you don't seek out so much or notice stuff that doesn't confirm what you believe. That's confirmation bias. The second problem is that when we are actually confronted with disconfirming evidence, when we actually do notice it, we work really hard to discredit it. So, does this sound about right? You read an article, it agrees with your political beliefs, and you go, that's such a great article. You read an article, it disagrees with your political beliefs, and you've written a dissertation about why the person's biased and all the data that they missed and all the reasons that their argument has holes and why they're wrong. Does that sound about right? So this is what we do all the time. When we're confronted with things that disagree with us, we work very hard to try to prove that they're not true. And when we're confronted with things that agree with us, we put basically no effort into it. We just think, oh, that's smart. And then here's the really bad thing. I mean, those two are pretty bad, but this is really bad. Even when we find out the evidence is wrong, our beliefs are still affected. Okay, so here's a really bad one. So I give half the room a study about how firefighters in their real life are real risk takers in their real life. They love taking risks. I give half the room a study, it's the exact same data, I just changed the labels on it, that shows that firefighters in their real life hate taking risks. They're very risk averse in their real life. And you can imagine I can come up with a good narrative as to why both of those things were true. So now this half of the room, I now test you guys on your attitudes about like how are firefighters in terms of their risk taking, and you all move in the direction of the evidence I've given you, and you all think that firefighters are big risk takers. I now test you guys, and you all think that firefighters don't take risks. Great. Now I come in and I tell you I made it up. It wasn't true. I made the study up. It's not a real thing. Okay, so you would think that now your attitudes would change. But I bring you in a week later, I test you again, and all of you think that firefighters are big risk takers, and all of you think that firefighters don't take risks. Now, this is a real problem, particularly when we think about presuppositions that people might have as they're interpreting other people. So, for example, when I was at the poker table, one of my big advantages was that people have really preconceived notions. They have very, very strong beliefs about how women are going to play. Right? Now, so you should think about this as you go into a negotiation or whatever you're doing. So they would have a very strong preconceived notion about how I was going to play. So what would happen when I played differently than their preconceived notion? I got called lucky more than I can even imagine. Because the idea that I might be playing in a way that didn't conform to the beliefs that they had about how a woman might play was very hard for them to sort of move off of. So they would just sort of reincorporate that if I did something really good, they would sort of pawn it off. If I was winning, they would work to disconfirm that that had to do with my own skill. And when I did something that wasn't so smart, because by the way, a lot of stuff that I did at the table wasn't so smart. There's a lot of luck and hidden information. You know, sometimes you don't make great decisions. They would now incorporate that into, you see, she plays like a girl. So I happen to be able to use that to my advantage, but don't be that person. We want to think about how can we make sure that we're building the most accurate model of the world so we don't end up like the people who are prejudging and then not able to move off of that belief that they already have because they're unwilling to listen to something that actually might calibrate their belief for them. So what is this process that's happening? It's called motivated reasoning. So basically, the way that we think that the world works is that we get information, and the information now informs our belief as if that's some sort of objective process. But it's not an objective process. What happens actually is that the beliefs that we have, which I've already told you are not formed in a particularly orderly way, the beliefs that we have actually actually drive the way that we process the information that come in. They decide how you view the information and what you're going to do with it in a way that's meant to reinforce the beliefs that are in the driver's seat. And now you get this circular thing happening where the beliefs change the way you look at the information, and then the information then reinforces the beliefs you already have, and it becomes this kind of, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. Right? So that's not such a good thing for decision making. And you can imagine this is what the problem with those poker players that I was playing against had. Right? They were living in uncertainty. It wasn't a certain answer. And they would do things and they wouldn't win, and they would just sort of incorporate it as, you know, well, that wasn't me, that was the uncertainty. And they would do things and they would win, even if they were bad things, and they'd say, you see, that was great. So this is how you can get into this really bad circular situation. So Simon and Garfunkel, always good to go to. Still a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Okay, so I've given you some good bad news so far. Now I'm going to give you some worse news. I'm going to get to some bright news in a second. But anyway, being smart makes it worse. So I'm sure many of you are thinking, that's so nice, Annie told me about this problem. She told me about resulting, and now she told me about motivated reasoning. She told me that, like, we don't really vet our beliefs, and we're not really good at hearing people who disagree with us, and people are really stuck in what they think, and so now I know about it, and I'm smart, and so I'm good. And the answer is no, that makes it worse. And there's two reasons, really. First of all, data are not truth, so you always need a human being to collect and interpret data, and it turns out that smart human beings are better at slicing and dicing data to support their beliefs. So there was a great study by Dan Kahan, which showed what he did was he gave people some data tables that were just about the effectiveness of a skin cream on psoriasis. Nobody has any priors about that. I mean, medical doctors do, but these people weren't, lay people. And he figured out, he just divided it into the people into two groups, the people who were very good at figuring out if the skin cream was effective for curing psoriasis and the people who were not so good. So people who were numerate, who were really data adept, are now in one group, and the people who are not so great with the data are now in another group, and now he just switches the labels on the data. And he makes it about something that he knows that people have very strong beliefs about, gun control and crime and the relationship between the two of them. He knows what the people's political viewpoints are in advance, and he now gives them the same data table. Everybody falls apart. They get worse at reading the data tables, but the people who get really bad are the ones who are really good at figuring out if skin cream cures psoriasis. So that's weird, right? Like, they're really good at reading those data tables, but as soon as you make it about something that they believe strongly about, they just read the data in the direction of what their belief is. So if they believe that gun control does lower crime, they see the data as saying that, regardless of what the data actually say. These are made up data tables. If they think there's no relationship between the two, that's how they see the data. And the smarter they are, the better they are with data that they don't have a strong belief about, the worse they are when they actually do have a strong belief. They've shown this with other things like solving logic problems and things like that. So their own beliefs are driving the way they look at this data. So why is that happening? Well, because when you're really good at something, you tend to have a lot of overconfidence in your intuition. So I'm a big intuition skeptic. I think intuition leads us astray a lot. And this is a good example of where intuition really leads you astray. So when you're really good at something, you're less likely to question that initial response you have to what you're looking at, because you think, I'm really good with data tables. So I can just sort of glance at this and I see that it confirms my belief and that's great, and you don't really question it. So what we need to worry about is that we're all, and everybody in this room is all, our own best PR agents. We're doing PR for ourselves every single day. And the PR that we're doing is for our beliefs. We like to be right. We like for the things that we already believe to be true. And so the way that we're interpreting the world is to tell a story that does good PR for us, that says the things I believe are true and I'm pretty competent and this is all pretty great. And this is kind of how we interact with the world mostly. So how can we solve for this? This is what I did with you. Well, let's remember that a decision is a bet, that there's always an uncertain future, that nothing can ever be 100% or 0% because there's too much hidden information. There's too much information asymmetry or illiquidity in the information market. That there's always luck in the way that things turn out. And so therefore, we can't really be certain. So if we embrace that uncertainty, we're going to be better at allocating our resources and figuring out what the best decision is, because we're actually seeing the world as it actually is. So when I said to you, do you want to bet? I reminded you of this. I reminded you that there's all sorts of things that could be true, and that in order to be a good decision maker, we need to recognize that there's all sorts of things that can be true besides the thing that you actually believe. And so it moved you off of that belief. Now, this was a pretty simple belief, but I can do this with anything that you believe. You can try this, like I've done this with my kids, where they're like, you know, do you want to go to this movie? No, it's going to be really bad. Do you want to bet? You can get your kids to do a lot more things like that. I use it as a tool all the time. All right, so what does betting do? It actually causes you to do step three, the vet. So it makes you ask questions that we don't otherwise ask ourselves, like where and when did you form the belief? What evidence do you have for the belief? I assume it was somebody told you or you heard it. Your mom, right? Your mom's a medical doctor, yeah? She's a nurse. Does she study genetics? No, okay, because I want a geneticist for this one, right? Exactly. So, and it's the same with me. Like, I have no idea where I heard it. The reason why it was in the book was because it was something I really strongly believed. And then when I went through this process, I was like, hey, I'm going to look that one up, because I actually don't know why I think that's true. I think I just heard that somewhere. I'm not sure. How reliable is the source of the evidence, right? So if they're not a geneticist, probably pretty unreliable in this case. Now, this is a really important one. What does the person challenging me to the bet know that I don't know? And what are the reasons the belief might not be true? So this is a very important concept. We can think about this as a question of inside view versus outside view. So the inside view is how we see things given our own thoughts and experiences and beliefs, sort of looking at the world from the inside out. The outside view is how people see it from the outside. Here's the best example I can give you of the inside view versus outside view. If I ask a newly married couple how often they think they'll get divorced, like what percentage of the time do you think this union here ends in divorce, they all say zero, which is probably good. But if I ask those same people, hey, there's a random couple over there that just got married, what percentage of the time do you think they're going to get divorced? Everybody answers 50%. Because 50% is the average. It's the base rate for divorce in this country. So what we understand is that we look from the outside in, we take into account all sorts of stuff that we don't when we look from the inside out. So someone else, someone from the outside, might be viewing our belief, might have different information, might have different data, might be parsing the information in a different way than we do, and we tend to ignore it because we really like to stay in the inside view. So when I say, do you want to bet, it makes you think, wait, does Annie know something that I don't know? What a great question to always ask yourself before you make a decision or before you decide that something's true. And that's what betting does. It also asks you, why might my belief not be true? So what I just told you with motivated reasoning is we're really, really good at knowing why the thing we believe is true. What we want to ask is why the thing we believe is not true. It's a much better way to think about the world. And basically what thinking in bets does, it gets you more willing to say I'm not sure, which is a more accurate representation of the world and our knowledge in it. And it also happens to make us more open-minded to dissent, especially dissent with our prior beliefs. Okay. So now I want to just lead to a different place that will get us to a solution. What if the Seahawks, this is a different thought experiment. What if the Seahawks had failed to score by running the expected play? So Pete Carroll hands the ball off, as expected, to Marshawn Lynch. And he tries to score, and he just doesn't. And the Patriots win. How many people think that the headlines the next day would have been, that's the worst call in Super Bowl history? Like three. How many people think that the headlines the next day would be, this is why the Patriots are a dynasty? The Patriots' line held. Okay, so all of those things don't have anything to do with Pete Carroll, right? Like, the Patriots are a dynasty. That doesn't have anything to do with Pete Carroll. The Patriots are just that good. Bill Belichick is such a great coach. Their line is so good. None of those things have to do with Pete Carroll. So that's kind of interesting. So if Pete Carroll chooses the thing that everybody expects, he neither gets called a genius nor a moron. it all sort of goes on to the greatness of the Patriots. All right, so what that tells us is that when we're making decisions, we kind of know this. So what's happening is that we're allowing it not to be Pete Carroll's fault when Pete Carroll takes the usual route. But when he takes an unusual route, when he does something that is not expected, that's when he gets excoriated. That's when he gets called a moron. Now, as human beings, we all know this. And what that makes us do is make decisions to try to get into the Pete Carroll handing off to Marshawn Lynch category. We're all trying to get to luck as a reasonable explanation for why things go wrong. This is what we're trying to do because we understand when we get blamed and when we don't. And so basically what happens is that we allow uncertainty to bubble up to the surface as an explanation for why the decision quality was what it was, is what it is, when we feel like the decision is transparent. So whether the outcome is good or bad, if we feel like we understand the decision, we're much more likely to allow that it might have been due to luck. This happens when we have consensus, when decisions are oft repeated, when they're status quo. So as an example, if you get in a car and you're going to the airport and you take the usual route and you've got your significant other in the car with you and there's an accident and there's traffic, but it's the way you go all the time and you leave at the normal time, there's no like, you know, we're breaking up in the car. How could you be so dumb? I can't believe you chose this stupid route. But if you take a shortcut, and in neither case is the traffic have anything to do with you. You can't predict it. But if you take that shortcut, all hell is breaking loose. So what does that do? That forces us into consensus decisions. It forces us to choose the status quo. And this is particularly problematic for people who think that they're more likely to get blamed for the status quo. Okay, so we know that resulting is an innovation killer because it chooses us to choose the path that allows for luck. It drives us to these decisions. We tend to use data as a shield to get there. And this is particularly problematic for women. And the reason why it's particularly problematic for women is that if we think about what's the transparency of the decision, when we feel like we don't understand the mind that's making the decision as well, that mind is much more likely to be blamed for the outcome. So I'll give you an example. Close to 7,000 pedestrians a year die because of a human driver in a car. I don't know if you remember, but about a year ago, a pedestrian died because of an autonomous vehicle. There was wall-to-wall coverage of that because obviously it was the algorithm's fault. Now, I didn't see any coverage of the pedestrians getting hit saying that, you know, we got to take human drivers off the road. This is the worst thing that's ever happened. Because we've all sort of decided, like, we understand, like, we know what the cost-benefit of that decision is, and human beings, you know, obviously the people aren't intending, they didn't get in the car intending to hit a pedestrian. So that's okay, like, because it's not intentional, so that was just bad luck for them. But as soon as an algorithm does it, it's like, we don't, the decision is a black box to us. And so therefore the algorithm gets blamed. Okay, so there's all sorts of places where you can see this with robot decision making, that when the outcome is bad, the robot gets blamed in a situation where a human being would not get blamed for the exact same decision. Now, when a woman is a minority in a group where it's a mostly male group and a woman is a minority, that woman's mind is more of a black box to the men. So our decisions end up having a lot more pressure on them because we're much more likely to get blamed for bad outcomes and we can feel it. And so that can drive us into more status quo decision making unless we do some things about it. Okay, so a lot of this comes from a problem of do as I say, not as I do, because what happens is we get put on the defensive or we can put people on defensive when we're in a leadership situation by actually having the quality of the outcome be the trigger for process rather than the unexpectedness of the outcome. So what do I mean by that? So we can say all we want, you know, I'm not worried about your outcomes, I'm just worried about the quality of your decisions. And we hear this a lot, particularly now, people are really understanding that being process-driven is much more important than being outcome-driven, that we shouldn't be results-oriented, we should be process-oriented, and people are really good at saying that stuff. But if you don't act like it, it won't actually instantiate. So let's say that you're in a real estate investing group and you invest in a piece of property and you have some model of how that's going to appraise, and the appraisal comes in and it's 10% lower than expected. We all know what happens, right? Like, everybody's in a room saying, what the hell happened? Why was our model wrong? But what if the appraisal comes in 10% higher than expected? Is everybody in the same room? Everybody's just going, we're so great. But the problem is, if we think about betting, the allocation of those resources really matters. Regardless of whether it's 10% too high or 10% too low, you're not going to actually, you're either underinvesting or overinvesting. Both of those are really big problems. So you should probably be in a room for both. But we're not in a room for both. So you can say process, process, process all you want, but you sound like the teacher in the Peanuts. Because what people see is, I get called in a room when I have a bad outcome. So what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask, how can I make a decision which is going to stop me from having a bad outcome, or which is going to be more status quo, so that when I get called in the room, I can say, what can I do? Everybody agreed with me. This is what we've always done. And it completely stops us from being able to innovate. And again, this is a bigger problem for women than for men. You can also get there by only asking, could we have done better, instead of asking, should we have done worse? So sometimes you should have actually done worse than you did. All right. So, last point. Effective scenario planning is actually a really good vaccine against this kind of problem. So if you include why am I wrong into your scenario plans, you approach decisions and belief from a position of thinking about why they not be true, and you have really good strategies for implementing that, like creating a subgroup that's a red team, which is just meant to argue against the consensus opinion, memorializing scenario plans that include dissenting voices, you're much more likely to not get into this trouble after the fact, because you will have thought about kind of the road to failure first. Now, I understand it's really uncomfortable to imagine failure. It's not a happy place to be. But by imagining failure and taking the time to say, how do these things go wrong? If it turns out that this didn't turn out well, why were we wrong now? You're actually much less likely to actually be wrong, because you figure out some of the roadblocks that might be in your way in advance. You memorialize it, you get people to buy into that, and now when things do go wrong, you're protected against somebody blaming you and resulting, and it allows you to be much more innovative. So I'm going to stop here so that I have time for questions. And hopefully there'll be lots of questions, because I would love to discuss this more. So thank you. Questions? There's a mic right there if you want to go up to it. Yeah. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for your talk. I work in a lot of machine learning applications. I'd love to get your thoughts on how we can better use machine learning in this better decision making.
Oh, thank you so much for that question. That's so great. Yeah. So there's things that machine learning and algorithms are really, really good for. When we have lots of data and the data is really well labeled. So machine learning basically allows us to get out of the problem of thinking about one outcome as if it's everything, right? So what happens to us is that we have this real emotional response to like a bad outcome or a good outcome, and it causes us to go down into a gravity well and not sort of be able to see out of it to like, well, what does all the data tell us, or what does the base rate tell us, and also how might we be driven by our beliefs in terms of the way that we look at the data. Machine learning is excellent for that particular type of problem in terms of algorithmic decision making is going to be better, for example, with a lot of like hiring decisions as an example, right? That it tends to be better at that. So we want to use algorithms for that kind of problem as a really good debiasing tool. The thing that we want to be really careful about with algorithms, though, is that algorithms are very data hungry. So I'll just give you one example. If you take an algorithm and you train it on Google Images to identify sisters, and you now ask it to go and label new pictures of sisters, it will only label pictures of white women. And the reason is that most of the images on Google of sisters happen to be white women. So one thing that we want to be careful about is, as we have data sets that might have bias in them, and obviously this is a problem for this room if we think about past data that might be coming in, we don't want to then reinforce that bias into the data set. So we want to have human beings with common sense who can say, wait a minute, that's silly, like not all white women are sisters. Or not all sisters are white women, rather. So what we want to do is have an interaction between human beings and data, where the data, the machine learning is actually acting to discipline the human, but the human is also acting to discipline the machine learning. One other thing really quickly is that machines are very bad at common sense. So as an example, if I train a machine on what a cat is, and then I say, what if it was a cat that was bigger than a house? And I ask it a question like, would you be scared of it? An algorithm can't answer that question, but all of you can, right? So we understand that we're much better at generalization, and machine learning isn't so great at that. But machine learning is very good at interpolation, and we're not so good at that. So we want to have a really good interaction between the two. And it will act as a very good disciplining effect on both of us.
Hi, Annie. My name is Ellie. Thanks so much for your appearance today. I've been a big admirer of yours for a long time.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask, you kind of hit about John Nash's game theory at the very beginning of your presentation, and I kind of studied that in college and really admire that frame of thought. So I wanted to see how you use that in this, or how does this kind of talk a little bit more about game theory?
Sure. So game theory is looking at how do we make decisions when there's other people involved and we have uncertainty and hidden information. So the classic game theory problem would be the prisoner's dilemma. Two people have committed a crime, they get put in separate rooms, they understand that if they both confess, they'll go to jail for like 3 years. If one confesses and the other doesn't, the confessor will go free and the other one will go to jail for 5 years, and vice versa. And if they both stay silent, they'll both only get 1 year. So, and I can change the payoff tables. And so what do they do? Because they're in separate rooms, right? So they don't know what the other one's going to say. And obviously there's a lot of luck in that, depending on what the other person does. So this idea of thinking in bets is really instantiating game theory. It's basically saying that when you make decisions, you have to think about what are the minds of others, how are other people viewing your decision, why might I be wrong? If I think about all the possible futures and my different options, what are the payoffs to those futures? That's actually how you get to the right answer about something like the prisoner's dilemma. So if the only thing that you walk away from here today with is my beliefs are not 0% or 100% true, they're somewhere in between, and as I think about the future, I can't guarantee which one will occur. There's always many possible futures that can occur. And I have to think about what the percentages of those are. And the best way to do that is by thinking about why I'm wrong. You've walked away with some really good game theory. Okay?
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi.
Amazing
talk.
Oh, thank you
for this. When you talked about beliefs, it got me thinking about how much information we consume on an everyday basis from news sources, social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and all the people that we follow, right from our political leaders to CEOs to celebrities, sports people, and how we sort of live in this bubble where in this day and age, I feel like our beliefs are even more strengthened by the overconsumption of information. So my question is there any antidote to basically not living in this bubble of just following people that you connect with or whose beliefs you sort of revalidate what you've already believed in? Sort of like, how do you break that feedback loop? Like, do you just go start following, like, political leaders that you have absolutely no connection with?
So thank you. That's such a great question. So yes, we do have information overload, and it's very easy to fall into an echo chamber. So we can think about the way that we sort of approach information. One would be a confirmatory style of thought, which is I'm sort of looking at the world to confirm the things I believe. The other would be a disconfirmatory style or an exploratory style, which is not a disconfirmatory style, but an exploratory style, which is I want to explore sort of what's accurate. So let's think about it as the difference between thinking about the world as am I right to thinking about the world as am I accurate. Those are really different things, right? So the first thing is go look at your Twitter feed and start following balance. That's number one. Now, I'm not saying that you should follow crazy people, like, you know, people who are absolutely off, you know, just like out there in terms of they're just trolls. But the people who are reasonable on both sides of the aisle, journalists, politicians, so on and so forth, get them in your Twitter stream so that you can see both of those things. That's number one. Then number two, go find a group of like-minded people who are willing to work on this with you and create a contract. We care about accuracy. We don't care about right. We're not just going to be an echo chamber talking about how great we are. If I think that you have said something that I disagree with, then I'm going to challenge you on it. And then if it's the case that we're going to be open-minded to dissent, and we're going to agree to disagree in a really, really polite way. And here's the frame difference. If you tell me something that I disagree with and I'm acting normally, I think that you've hurt me. But if we think about it intentionally, then if you don't tell me something that disagrees with me, I think that you've hurt me. And if you can start to shift your thinking to that, you'll start to consume information in a much healthier way. So I'm out of time. But I'm going to be doing a book signing, and I'm going to be outside, so I'm happy to answer questions that nobody got to, because I don't know, where's the book signing going to be so I can tell them? The next room. So I will be there and happy to take time with anybody. Thank you.